Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My special guest today is George Komasoulis, the National Cancer Institute's Deputy Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics, NIT, and Acting Chief Information Officer. George, this is a return visit for you on Ask the CIO. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So last time we spoke, it was several years ago, January 2011. I was looking back through some old articles and realized it's been 3 years since you're on. So there's a ton to talk about. So first, we're going to jump into some of your old priorities. One of them at the time was the move or the use of Internet 2 to share data. What's the status of that effort? How is it improving the way you deal with big data?
We do utilize Internet 2 for a number of our large-scale sort of data transfers in certain contexts. We're not at the point where we have dedicated Internet 2. We use an Internet 2 line that's shared with the rest of the NIH, primarily because we, frankly, are just moved to a new facility at Shady Grove. We have new data centers there, and we haven't really had time to decide what is the most efficient strategy to provide Internet 2 connectivity to our organization once we now that we're up at Shady Grove. Nonetheless, it is, as I say, it's an important part of the way in which we transfer large amounts of information, particularly related to some of our genomics efforts.
And just for our listeners who maybe aren't quite sure what Internet 2 is, because they're still on, Internet 1 with the dial-up modem, what is it? How does it work? It's basically, it's a way to share data, but more, there's more to it.
So it's a research network, and it's also that, as I say, the NIH is a member of it. It is there to provide high bandwidth networking for scientific research and associated activities. And again, that's why the NIH is a member, and we have Internet 2 connectivity to the NIH. So where the Internet 2 backbone, I believe, is going up to 100 gigabits, this is the kind of thing that scientists who generate large amounts of data, and I'll tell you that we have one project that's going to have generated something in the order of 2.5 petabytes of data by the end of this fiscal year. Clearly moving that kind of information around requires high bandwidth channels.
How much is this being used nowadays? Is it widespread?
Sure. I mean, I think potentially because it's been associated more with educational institutions, universities, and the like. And of course, obviously, as big data starts to pervade science, both within the context of biology and physics, weather, et cetera, having high bandwidth channels to move things around is important. I mean, obviously, Internet 2 is not the totality of our strategy for dealing with big data or transferring large amounts of information from point to point, but it certainly is something that we can use to assist us.
All right, I imagine we're going to talk more about big data and big data analysis as we get into some of your newer priorities. But before I do that, let's flash back again to 2011. At that time, you were just finishing up your National Cancer Institute's IT strategy. Obviously, that strategy is now almost four years old. What's next? How did it kind of set in motion where you're at now compared to where you were, again, 3 years ago?
3 years ago, of course, we were developing a new IT strategy, not the least of which was because we were moving a large number of the NCI staff. 2,500 of them were moving to a new facility that's called NCI Shady Grove. We were building out new data centers. So, and of course, our IT strategy had to deal with enabling both our intramural scientists. These are the people who do biomedical research, as well as the scientists who manage grant portfolios, which is, of course, a huge part of what the NCI and the NIH more broadly does. We had to make sure that our IT strategy was going to provide the sort of lowest activation energy for them to be able to do their jobs. You know, right now, obviously, we're looking at revising our IT strategy to deal with the reality of 2014 as opposed to the reality of the 2011. We have the same goal, right? Efficient delivery of IT resources. We may use different technologies than we might have selected in 2011 and 2014. And we've been using our new Shady Grove facility, which the move into completed in June of 2013, to sort of work through much of our new IT strategy, our new IT infrastructure, I should say, that was based on the strategy at the time we were talking about. Things like improved network architecture with better segmentation so that we have enhanced security of our network segments, better network access control and monitoring. We have a full-on network access control or NAC implementation going on out at Shady Grove, better survivability, unified communications or VoIP. And, you know, we changed a lot of the ways in which we do our acquisitions for some of our capital equipment. We've been switching to leasing with option to own or upgrade, but with option year periods so that we have high degrees of flexibility if we need additional equipment or less equipment. And given that the sort of funds rate is so low for a very, very small increase in annualized cost, we can, you know, sort of straighten out our capital budget so we don't have, you know, these huge spikes that acquisitions sometimes tended to do, particularly with equipment that you have to update on a fairly regular basis.
Let me jump in real quick, and sure. I'd like to pull the string a little bit more on the leasing of equipment, because it's something that I think we heard at one time and that we're hearing less about. So you're leasing, for instance, the PC that's under your desk.
No, not actually things like PCs. This tends to be major, we're moving toward leasing sort of major capital IT equipment, okay, network switches or large storage arrays and whatnot. Things that have have a very sort of real shelf life. They have to be upgraded on a fairly regular basis. And depending on the nature of what you have, you may need more or less of it at any arbitrary time. By doing this, we get ourselves into a regular refresh cycle on this equipment. We bring in new technology when it's required. And, you know, I think that overall we wind up with lower cost. When you buy stuff, you have a tendency to hang on to it until it completely dies. But you wind up spending a lot more money on support and the like. This gives us, if you will, where we're leasing the equipment, we're managing it ourselves in our data centers. So I guess that's a slightly different approach than, you know, you've been talking about right there. And again, it does prevent huge spikes in your sort of capital budget. It helps allow it to operate on a more predictable sort of schedule.
And I think one of the things about leasing as well is, as you said, if you need to go up, it's easy enough to do that versus you go through an acquisition process where you have to buy 10 new servers and it may take 6 months to get that 10 new servers. Now, I imagine you call your provider and say, hey, it looks like we're going to need 2 new servers in the next week and they can deliver it. Is that accurate?
And the important point as well is that you can go down. All right. If it turns out that you don't need as much as you thought, or to be frank, if the particulars of the technology which you've chosen either simply don't work very well in your environment, or, you know, they hit a point where they're obsolete, because these are based on option years, you can balance out the kind of equipment and not necessarily be locked into equipment that, you know, you were bought on a 5-year plan, but decide that you only actually require for 3.
Has that decision to lease, has it been fairly well accepted by your management? Because, I mean, people think of leasing cars. I mean, that's the thing that most of us think about when we talk about leasing stuff, maybe renting an apartment, renting a house, but IT equipment is not really something we ever think about. We all buy our laptops, we all buy our smartphones.
And again, we don't actually lease everything. We tend to buy our PCs. We tend to buy smartphones and things of that nature.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we have one more priority that you gave us a little bit of a mention on, VoIP. Mm-hmm. We will talk more about that. But first, you're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is George Komitsoulis, the National Cancer Institute's Acting Chief Information Officer.
As a manager, you need to know how you can make your organization more efficient. Listen for Management Friday on Federal News Radio. We bring you information on the keystone of success for any agency or business. Friday mornings at 10, listen for AFGE's perspective on inside government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to hear what career options may be available. Management Friday, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is George Komitsoulis, the National Cancer Institute's Acting Chief Information Officer. Now, George, before break, we're talking a lot about some older priorities. We talked about the Internet 2 and the use of it throughout the NCI, your IT strategy, and how it kind of led the way toward leasing of major capital IT and some other around cybersecurity, which I imagine we'll come back around to in a little bit. But a third major priority back in 2011 was the use of voice over IP VoIP. Now, this was talking about the move to Shady Grove. This was right before, as you were planning the move to Shady Grove, you said we're gonna look at VoIP and maybe even use it in the new facility. So where are you with it, and how does it relate to unified communications you mentioned earlier?
We do, in fact, obviously now use voice over IP quite a lot. We tend to think of it not so much as voice over IP, which at some level refers to the telephony aspect of it, as unified communications. So that is voice over IP telephony, things like messaging, voicemail systems and whatnot that integrate with electronic mail, so that, for instance, when I get a voicemail these days, it drops a copy into my email and I can pick it up from my mobile device or from my computer, as well as integration with our video conferencing system. So we have a very sort of unified system, particularly out at the Shady Grove complex. We've reached a point where the video conferencing goes down to the individual desktop, goes down to the individual device that sits on a person's desk. So we've pushed video conferencing down to there. And again, it's integrated with our email system. It's integrated with the conference rooms that were set up at Shady Grove, so that at least the hope is at Shady Grove, you learn how to use one conference room and you can use all of the conference rooms. We did a sort of a three-phase approach to this because VoIP was, while certainly not new out in the broader world, it was certainly new at the NIH. We did a pilot that was internal to the IT organization at the NCI, 50 to 100 people. And then we switched over to a production pilot to a new facility that the NCI was using out in Frederick, Maryland. There were about 100 people in that pilot. And unlike our initial pilot at the NCI's IT offices, where people still had their old ISDN phones, when we went out to Frederick, they had only the VoIP phones. And so we were able to get a lot of good experience sort of running a real-time production environment there for moving to the full-scale production at Shady Grove, which, as I've sort of said, is about 2,500 people. I think it's been very successful at the NCI. As I say, we've pushed the video conferencing out to the desktop. We've pushed it out to the handset. It's been very useful supporting scientific collaborations at the NCI. We've used it to help manage our FACA commission meetings. These are the Federal Advisory Commission Act meetings. This has actually, you know, had some significant savings, frankly, in terms of travel, because we can provide desktop clients for the members of these commissions and then have some of these meetings completely virtually. Now, obviously, there's value still to be having face-to-face meetings, so not all of them go that way, but we're increasingly using it. It's been great for teleworkers. It's been great for travelers, people who go out into, you know, who are traveling on behalf of the government. I myself have been out of the country and made phone calls and participated in teleconferences and the like from out of the country using the very inexpensive wireless access in hotels, and using my IP telephone on my laptop instead of either, you know, using direct phone services or international calls on mobile devices. So that's been quite helpful. And actually, after for those of you obviously remember the earthquake we had here, one of our deputy directors was supposed to have been presenting on an international video conference and was supposed to have done it from the NCI, but unfortunately, he was not allowed to go back into the office, so our UC person was able to do a little scramble and let him attend this international meeting from his home. You know, it's just been a real boon to us. We're very, 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 very happy with it.
Was the culture change to get people onto VoIP hard, or did people see the value for
us? No, it's been very clear, and in fact, I think you're starting to see it broadly across the NIH, that they see how well it works and deciding that this is something that we're going to want to do. The value proposition on this was really obvious. And particularly for us moving into a new facility, one of the things that we were able to do was simplify the network, simplify the cabling, right? We didn't need a phone network and a computer network. We needed a computer network. Obviously, we keep them on separate VLANs, but nonetheless, it really made cabling the facility a much, much simpler problem.
Let's move over to another priority. A couple of years ago, you were talking about mobile apps, especially biomedical informatics support. Mobility is a big issue now. Obviously, everyone's got a smartphone, a tablet computer. Where has mobility progressed for the last few years from your perspective?
This is still one of the major opportunities that we have in biomedicine, is to leverage the fact that so many people now have smartphones to collect a lot more biomedical information. I don't think where we need to be or where we're going to be in the next couple of years, but this is, I think, something we're going to obviously be taking a look at. We've been using a few other sorts of things in the less biomedical space. We're starting to support a lot more bring-your-own-device type capabilities, so that someone who works for the federal government and wants to be able to securely access federal resources can use apps to connect to those federal resources on their personal devices without having to worry so much about mixing the federal information and their own personal information, which I think is something that we're starting to sort of work on. One of the more interesting apps I think that's come out of NCI recently is something called QuitPal that is designed to help people who are trying to quit smoking work through that process. But I think we're still in the infancy of using mobile applications and mobile tools to really collect biomedical information.
All right, we're going to take another quick break, and we'll come back and talk cloud and some other priorities. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My guest today is George Komosolis, the National Cancer Institute's acting chief information officer.
So, guess what I just heard?
You mean about the Roth TSP?
Okay, yeah. Well, also,
that bid protest on the DOD contract.
Right, but did you know
who the Senate confirmed for the administrator's job?
Well, what about
OMB's digital strategy?
Jeez, how do you know everything that's going on in the federal government?
I know, because I signed up for Federal News Radio's email alerts.
Be in the know and know it first with Federal News Radio's email alerts. Sign up today at federalnewsradio.com. Search email alerts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is George Komosolis, the National Cancer Institute's acting chief information officer. George, before break, we were talking a little bit about some of your older priorities. One of them was mobile apps. When you talk mobile, you can't help but talk about cloud computing. I think the last time we spoke, again, about 3 years ago, one of the things was the use of private cloud, something that you were just starting down the path. Are you still in private clouds? Have you jumped into the public cloud? Tell us where you are with cloud computing.
We do actually have several items in private clouds right now. And I apologize, but I find cloud computing to be one of those words that can mean an awful lot to a lot of different people. So the two things I'll just mention to you, number one is something we call CG Hub, which is short for Cancer Genomics Hub. It's a repository for storing files from high-volume genome sequencing. It's actually, that is a private cloud providing storage, so in many ways it's sort of an infrastructure as a service kind of thing. The other area where we have a fair amount of what I'll call cloud presence is in our clinical data management system. So these are the systems that are used to collect clinical information during clinical research, clinical trials. In that case, we're using software as a service in a private cloud. The organization that we get our clinical data management system hosts it as a software as a service kind of space. That's the sort of private cloud. We haven't moved nearly as much into the public cloud space as of yet. As you know, it's comparatively recently that many of the public cloud providers have obtained FedRAMP certification, and obviously this is one of the things that we will continue examining over time, is whether or not our various IT needs can be best, which is to say highest quality, lowest cost, making that sort of best value determination, whether it can be best done in the cloud or in a public cloud, in a private cloud, or done in-house.
One of the things that when I've talked to Frank Bateman, the Health and Human Services Department's chief information officer, so the CIO boss of all bosses at HHS,
yes,
he's definitely talked about moving stuff to the cloud. Is that train you're getting on in terms of whether it's email or whether it's other types of as a service?
At the end of the day, we want to provide the best value for IT services at the lowest cost to the taxpayer. And when we can use cloud for that, whether it's email, whether it's scientific computing, we will you know, head in that path. Where we can best do it in a private cloud, we'll head in that path. Where we can best do it in-house, we'll head in that path.
Sounds to me like you haven't made a decision yet which way you're going. So
we haven't. I think the key thing is we haven't made a generic decision that we're going to put everything in a public cloud or everything in a private cloud or everything in-house. I think we're going to assess how we can get the best value for the taxpayer.
Let's jump to another recent cloud development. This is a broad agency announcement that you guys actually have on the street right now for a cancer genomics cloud pilot. Let's talk about that a little bit and give us some details. I know you're limited because it's an active procurement, sure, but tell us what you can.
To really understand why we went down this particular path of this broad agency announcement that I'll give you a little bit of information on, I think you need to understand a little bit about basic cancer biology. Within human beings and any organism for that matter, you constantly have cells that are growing, that are dividing, that are making specialized cells, and that sometimes are going through what's called programmed cell death. Scientists call that apoptosis. And having this constant change is really, it's very important, right? If you exercise, you need more muscle, so you need to build muscle cells. But of course, it's important that your muscles develop muscle cells, okay, and that the lining of your intestine develop cells that are specific to the lining of your intestine. And you don't want to be generating new cells, new muscles, new lining of intestine if, in fact, it doesn't need to be replaced. Otherwise, you'd keep growing. There'd be all kinds of problems. Generally speaking, within organisms, this process of growth, scientists call it proliferation and programmed cell death, apoptosis, and creating specialized cells called differentiation is under very strict control. And that, like I said, that control is very important. When that control gets out of whack is when you have cancer. And one of the things that we've learned over time and that the Institute of Medicine recently put forward in a report calling for precision medicine is that we as oncologists have been classifying cancer wrong. An oncologist typically specialized in a particular location where disease occurred. Maybe you were a colon cancer specialist. Maybe you were a breast cancer specialist. Maybe you were a brain cancer specialist. But the reality is a specific tumor in the brain may be much more similar to a tumor in breast or in colon than it is to another tumor that happens to exist in the brain. And the only way that we're going to sort of be able to figure this out is to take a look at a large number of tumors, do sequencing of that patient's DNA, as well as other characterizations of those cells. And that will give us an idea of how the various tumors in particular locations are related to each other. And we can correlate that with how well a patient responds to a particular treatment to really advance the ability to get better treatments for cancer. Well, what that means is, again, as a practical matter, is that we're going to wind up generating a lot of data. And there is a project that was jointly started by the National Cancer Institute and the National Human Genome Research Institute, the NHGRI, called the Cancer Genome Atlas. And the goal of the Cancer Genome Atlas is to collect this kind of information on 11,000 patients. And by the end of this fiscal year, we're going to have 2.5 petabytes of data from this individual project. Well, you know, 2.5 petabytes of data, just to store a copy of it, I mean, just ignoring everything else, any of the analytics or whatnot, is a $2 million a year sort of proposition. And obviously, it's not a particularly efficient proposition if you've got, you know, a couple of 100 research universities that all want to keep an individual copy of this information. The other problem, to be perfectly honest, is 2.5 petabytes is 20 million gigabits. If you had a dedicated 10 gigabit per second line and there was no network latency and you didn't have to share it and 20 million gigabits is 23 days to download a copy. Given, you know, reality, you need a calendar to download this information and make it available, not a stopwatch. So looking at this problem, we wanted to make sure at the NCI, we wanted to make sure that this information was going to be widely available to use. And given these problems associated with keeping local copies and having to transfer it, so instead what we concluded was that we needed a computing environment, I'll call it that, we can call it a cloud for convenience sake, that co-located the data, as well as computing resources, servers, and the like, and had an application programming interface so that we could have secure access to both the data and the resources that were available. So that that smart graduate student doesn't download a copy. He writes a, or she writes a piece of software, uploads it to this cloud, runs it on the data, and brings it back. Well, at some level, I think that's a, you know, that's something we could all agree on, but what we didn't know was what is the best way to do this? What's the best technical solution? And so rather than trying to build something that would serve our needs for the next 3 to 5 years right away, you know, which would be, my estimate would be 10 to 20 petabytes size, instead we took a page out of the acquisition of aircraft. So we put out a broad agency announcement for a cancer genomic cloud pilot. It has to be scaled for 2.5 petabytes, what we're going to have by the end of this fiscal year. It has to handle the core data, which is the DNA sequence plus some RNA sequence, some clinical annotations. Each pilot needs to also pick up one of the other data types that comes from the Cancer Genome Atlas project. So we have a nice broad view. We'll award 3 of these things, just like in the aircraft example. You choose the best couple. You give those that entity some funds so that they can build flying prototypes, and then you fly them off against each other. We're going to do the same thing here. Okay, our plan is to fund 3 of these. We'll have them build out these capabilities. It'll give us some core data that we can use for apples-to-apples comparison, but also give us a nice broad collection of data types that scientists can use, at which point we'll fly them off against each other and let scientists vote with their feet.
Timing on this, I know there's some procurement sensitivities. Can you give me a sense of when you hope to get these awards done and then when the bake-off or fly-off will happen?
Sure. So the proposals are due on, at least at the moment, on February 27th. And, we hope to make an award approximately September sort of time frame. The project itself is set up into 3 phases, an initial phase of 6 months, a second phase of 9 months, at which point the clouds are due to be delivered. And then the final 9-month phase is the evaluation phase where, among other things, we're going to open it to the research community so that, again, they get an opportunity to try things out and vote with their feet.
Good, and sounds like we will have you back on before another 3 years leaves us. That's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today was George Komotsoulis, the National Cancer Institute's Deputy Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics and IT and the Acting Chief Information Officer. George, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.